Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Joanna Schwartz. She's a professor of law at UCLA, who challenges law enforcement's untouchability, if you will, when they might be guilty of misconduct, and specifically overuse of the claim of qualified immunity. This all happens in her book, Shielded, How the Police Became Untouchable. And you can learn more about Joanna's work at joannaschwartz.net. J-O-A-N-N-A-S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z, Joanna Schwartz, all one word, .net. On Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, law, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. As I was preparing for the show, it occurred to me that though my aim is to envision a world that just might work, as I say, on the way there, I spend a lot of time learning how and why things are even worse than I thought. So just in the recent past, in the last few podcasts, I learned from Jeff Goodell, the author of The Heat Will Kill You First, that climate change is not like smog. If and when we finally do everything right, things won't go back to the way they were. It's highly likely that the heat, droughts, wildfires, and floods are here to stay. Things that I knew were suspect or even dangerous, when I dig into them, often reveal ways in which our legal system is actually set up to allow or promote such bad behavior. I've long been suspect of private equity, for example. I assume there are exceptions, but I associate it with the worst cutthroat capitalism, destroying companies, communities, individual lives. And then I learned from Brendan Ballou, author of Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America, that they have successfully manipulated the legal system to escape accountability for the consequences of their actions, hiding behind the claim that they advise investors, they do not control companies. From Dan Ziblatt, co-author of Tyranny of the Minority, I learned a greater appreciation of the flaws of the Constitution currently being exploited to impose minority rule by the Republican Party and the right, and that the founders of one of the first democracies were driven actually by a fear of the people, of mob rule, of the tyranny of the majority. So I'm prepared to learn some similar things today about police misconduct and accountability from Joanna Schwartz. She begins Shielded with a quote from James Baldwin, "Ignorance allied with power is the most ferocious enemy justice can have." And she declares her ambitions for the book to be, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced." So I know I'm going to learn more bad news about why things are the way they are. So to frame the conversation, I'm interested first in the macro, like national numbers, perhaps. How big a problem is the current state of police accountability? And are we doing better since the death of George Floyd and the protests of 2020? Joanna Schwartz writes, "Myths about the dangers of making it too easy to sue police have made a mess of our system. We need a shared understanding of why officers must be held accountable for their actions and a commitment to end senseless legal protections that embolden police and leave victims without a meaningful remedy." And I have spent much of my academic career empirically examining justifications for qualified immunity doctrine and have found each to be overblown and sometimes just plain false. It's past time to get the facts straight about what qualified immunity is, what it does, and what would happen if it were eliminated. So, we'll look into how big a problem is qualified immunity. How often is it claimed? How effective is it? What impact does it have on victims and their families and on law enforcement? So that's, we'll set the big picture. And then I want Joanna to share stories. She promises in the introduction to Shielded, readers will learn the stories of people whose children were killed, even though they posed no threat. People who themselves were shot and nearly lost their lives without justification, who were searched and humiliated without cause, who were raped by officers sworn to protect and serve, each of whom has been told by our courts and elected officials that they must shoulder the costs of the violence they suffered themselves, with no recourse from the officers or from the governments that signed their paychecks and gave them their badges and guns. In individual cases where qualified immunity has been claimed and granted, what impact does it have on justice, accountability, and closure for the victims of police misconduct? And finally, what can be done, what should we hope for, and how can we help? Joanna Schwartz is a professor of law at UCLA, where she teaches civil procedure and courses on police accountability and public interest lawyering. Her writing, commentary, and research about police misconduct, qualified immunity, indemnification, and local government budgeting have been featured in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Forbes, NPR, Network News, CNN, NPR. She's a graduate of Brown University and Yale Law School, and her first book, released early this year, is Shielded: How the Police Became Untouchable. Welcome, Joanna Schwartz, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful to be on with you.
Great. And let me tell listeners, we are recording this conversation Monday, October 23rd. First of all, Joanna, I'd like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas we talk about. So can you tell us, in your words briefly, a bit about how you see your path to the work you do these days and to the life you've led? And feel free to go back. It might be a childhood inspiration, a mentor, a turning point, those sorts of things.
Well, I first decided to go to law school after working at an alternative to prison program in the Bronx in New York City, where my job was as a court representative to interview a bunch of people who had been charged with their first felonies, usually first-time drug offenses. They were usually teenagers. And advocate for them before the judge and the prosecutor to get released from jail, to be able to live back at home, go to our program, and hopefully end up with a sealed record at the end. And the experience of being in that courthouse every day, day in and day out, cemented my interest in going to law school. It also really cemented my interest in criminal justice reform and seeing all of those people, you know, mostly black and brown, coming through the courthouse every day. When I went to law school, I thought I was going to be a public defender, but I started doing work, civil rights work. I represented a bunch of several different women who had been raped by corrections officers in a federal prison in Connecticut. And that experience got me thinking about the criminal justice system, not from the criminal perspective, but from the civil rights perspective. And I really became passionate about that side of the work, representing people whose rights had been violated. And that's what I ended up doing after law school. I worked at a small civil rights firm in New York City. And while I was doing that work, a lot of the questions that end up informing this book came to mind about what effect these lawsuits were actually having, why it was so hard to bring these claims and win, and what effect they were having on officers and departments when they were successful. So when I got to UCLA and started my work as a professor, I really spent my time trying to empirically answer the questions that plagued me as a young lawyer bringing these cases. And it's really driven my work ever since. I've wanted to understand why it is so difficult to bring these cases. And ultimately, as I explain in Shielded, I think that there is a series of claims, myths, concerns about the dangers of too much justice in these cases that have been used by courts and by legislators to create multiple overlapping barriers to relief that make it very difficult even for people with very legitimate claims who've suffered very serious harms to get the relief that I believe they deserve.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Let me ask one question right at sort of in the middle of that, which is, what drew you, or how did you make the decision to really embed yourself in extensive statistical and other research that you've done over the years to test the validity of claims for the need for qualified immunity, for example. This is not everyday legal scholarship, is it?
It is not what a lot of people who do legal scholarship spend their time doing. I mean, I suppose there are a couple of answers to that question. One is that that was what interested me. That's uh-huh. what I wanted to understand. As one example, that I talk about in the book, I had a client who had brought a claim against an officer and against the department. The officer had beaten him up several times. He was clearly a bad apple officer. The department was trying to fire him. And the officer offered him a healthy six-figure settlement. And my client wanted to know where the money was supposed to be coming from to satisfy this settlement. My assumption was that it couldn't be coming from the department because the department was trying to fire him. But when we dug down and demanded that information, really at the behest of our client, we learned that it was the police department that was going to pay this six-figure settlement on behalf of an officer they were trying to fire, who had clearly engaged in egregious wrongdoing. So that's a question that stuck with me. I couldn't get to the answer while I was busy litigating his case,
right.
But when I had the time to think about it, I really wanted to know the answer to the question. Why would this department have paid in this case, and how frequent was it that departments did pay on behalf of their officers? And so it was truly my goal was not to do something unique and different, you know, as compared to my law school professor colleagues, but it was really to answer questions that I found fascinating. And because I have experience as a litigator, I have experience doing discovery and taking depositions and interviewing people and doing public records requests, the kind of skills that I needed to get to the bottom of the questions that I wanted to ask were actually skills that I had developed during my time in practice.
Very good. Very good. And so now let me shift just a second here to say, any response to my introduction, anything in there that's off or, you know, just anything?
No, I loved it. And I really appreciate the wide lens that you offered in the introduction, thinking about, first of all, the idea that to come to solutions, you need to grapple with what the problems are, and that the problems are often much more profound than you might expect. I think that that's a very important frame because that is the frame of Shielded as well. I do think that it's in some ways easier to come up with solutions when you don't truly grapple with what the problems are.
God,
and,
yes.
And a nuanced understanding of what the problems are has got to be the first step. I also really like the fact that you were sort of cross-substantive in the introduction. This is an issue. This book is really, it's just about a sliver of an issue. And in fact, it's only a sliver of the policing issues related to accountability, because there are, I could have written a book about, boy, what would a better functioning criminal justice system or criminal system work to arrest and imprison officers? Or what would a better internal affairs system, how would that work where police departments were doing a better job of policing their own? Instead, I really just focus on one sliver. What does our civil justice system look like? How do people get justice in the courts through seeking money or court-ordered reforms when their rights have been violated? And as you point out, these are questions not only that, you know, you've faced with policing, but with the environment and with corporate power and all of these other areas as well.
Exactly. No, it was, you know, it's as I'm preparing for something, you know, there's these thoughts running around in my brain and I'm going, this just keeps happening, where I think something is a problem. And I want it. And then I find out that there's like a deeply embedded systemic reason that the problem seems so challenging, or that the effect mm-hmm. seems so immense that the public just is unaware of, and that the normal, I mean, and I was going to say the normal, you know, media dealing with these issues never really reveals. But I obviously read and research much more than just the mainstream, you know, In other words, this is stuff that I'm paying. And in the cases I mentioned, and in the case of this book, and you know, all too often, it turns out when you scratch below the surface, you find out that there are, as I point out, and as your book is one of the examples of, that the legal system has somehow been twisted to actually, as I say, either condone or promote what seems like bad behavior, and certainly not, if you will, well-being.
Yeah, I agree absolutely, and we will get into the substance of the book. But you know, I think you mentioned in the introduction a great deal about qualified immunity. But part of my goal in telling the story of this book and writing this book is to make clear that qualified immunity is only the tip of the iceberg. And there are many, many other barriers to relief as well. And I think this is an example exactly of what you were just saying, that even when you look at more in-depth media, more in-depth than, you know, Twitter or other kinds of social media, there still is a focus predominantly on qualified immunity, but there's many other barriers to relief.
Right. Now, I noticed
as well,
it seemed to me that when I looked at articles you'd written lately or attention that had been paid to the book, that it seems that the focus does seem to be on qualified immunity. In other words, there would be people that would say, oh, this is the qualified immunity book. So...
it's a bit of a self-fulfilling, you know, self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Because I keep trying to say it's not just about
right.
qualified immunity, guys. And they say, well, yes, but tell us more about qualified immunity, which I'm happy to do. But there is a lot more involved.
Right. And I will end up doing the same damn thing. but for right now, let me ask you a couple of questions. I said that you're ambition. I quoted you on your ambition for the book, but if you want to enlarge on that at all, and because my guess is that one begins a book, and I let me throw in one other question. A question I often ask was there a moment you knew you had to write this? Was a particular itch that you just had to scratch? Was there a thing when it was, damn it, I guess I've got to do it? Was there that moment?
Yeah, and it is a good question to answer the broader question that you were posing. You know, I've done a lot of legal research, writing articles, you know, more than a dozen articles in the 10 plus years that I've been a law professor that offer, you know, with hundreds of footnotes, the findings of the various studies that I have done. But for those who don't like to read law review articles for fun on the weekends, they can be a little bit, you know, frightening to look at. But I've also done a lot of popular press and talking with reporters and the like. But after George Floyd's murder, and there was all of this focus and attention on qualified immunity and on police accountability and barriers to relief, I was getting a ton of calls about qualified immunity for sure, but also about other areas of my research. Who pays when these cases are successful? What impact does it have on police departments' budgets? You know, when are local governments held responsible?
Right. In other words, once the conversation becomes about funding or defunding or changing funding of police, then suddenly people say, well, that's something I know nothing about. How are they funded, and what would changes in funding mean? That sort of thing. And so,
Exactly. And that was in the midst of those conversations, I thought, boy, I should be writing a book instead of responding to all of these reporters' calls all the way. I mean, of course, I still do that. But what I wanted to do was explain in it for a lay audience who doesn't want to read those law review articles what these various barriers to relief are, qualified immunity among them, but to make sure that people understand it's not just qualified immunity, it's this web of different protections. That was one main goal. And the second main goal was to share my research and the research of other scholars who have tested the justifications for these many barriers to explain that they don't bear out that
right.
that the reasons that we have all these barriers are myths and concerns that really bear minimal relationship to reality.
Yeah,
so, those are the paired goals.
Yeah, that second one, the fact that you finally do the research, you look at the real numbers, and these Supreme Court decisions are driven by myths, and the actions of governments and police departments and prosecutors are driven by myths. At this point, it's not surprising, but it's saddening and disheartening, mm-hmm. Especially in terms of the Supreme Court. I have a nephew who is clerking for a federal judge and will next year, the year after, clerk for a Supreme Court judge. And I asked him, what is your job? And he said, my job is reading, you know, and writing. And I read all day long and then I write drafts. And that the reading of the Supreme Court justices would not have yielded them the information that you put in this book for the public is, as I said, disheartening. So,
of course, I hope that they read the book and your nephew does as well. So the information is now there. And I will say there are a lot of federal judges who have cited my research and others' research about what is actually happening on the ground as they question doctrines like qualified immunity. Why do we have this? So it is getting into the conversation. I don't know if it will change votes or to the extent to which it has changed votes, but I do hope it changes at least the baseline understanding of how these cases
function. People still may vote based on something other than the facts and maybe even
exactly.
other than the myth. The question that is upstream of anything we say about qualified immunity is, how would you describe or assess the state of law enforcement accountability in the U.S. today? And are things getting better since George Floyd? And if so, how?
Yeah, it's a great question. And when you first asked it in the or posed it in the introduction, I smiled to myself because the first sort of baseline answer is going to be an unsatisfying one, which is that we don't really know. And there's an overarching problem, which is that we don't have great data about how often police violate people's rights. We have the most basic information that we have, which concerns how often police kill people, is data that's not collected by the federal government, that they've been essentially incapable of collecting themselves. It's data collected by The Guardian and The Washington Post. And that has found that the number of killings by police is numbers over 1,000, and that the numbers have stayed relatively the same or have gone up
data. Oh, Joanna, what's the time period for that 1,000?
I believe the first year of collection was 2014.
Uh-huh. So it's 1,000 since 2014 in the U.S.
1,000 each year.
That's what I was asking
each
for.
Year.
Yeah.
Yes, more than 1,000 each year. Of course, we don't know what the numbers were, in the 90s, 80s, 50s, 40s. I'm guessing they were higher. So in the scheme of things, the numbers may well have gone down over the decades, but they haven't gone down, over the past 10 years. And we don't have other data that is reliable, although again, journalists are working to start collecting the data of how many times people believe that their rights have been violated other ways, that non-fatal excessive force have been used against them, or they've been wrongfully searched or detained and the like. So there's a lot we don't know. What I can tell you is, as far as accountability is concerned, there's three sort of main ways in which people can get some form of accountability. One is through a criminal prosecution. Available evidence is that those criminal prosecutions of officers are vanishingly rare. Something like 2% of officers who have killed people have any charges against them, and then around a third of those are convicted of anything. The numbers are much smaller, although we don't have those exact numbers for non-fatal force or other kinds of violations that don't involve the use of force. And internal affairs investigations are another path. That would be police departments investigating, disciplining, firing officers. These are also rare. And in part, this is because of protections that are part of state law, part of union agreements with local departments that, you know, limit how investigations are run and then often create these arbitration appeals of any findings of discipline. So then we're left with lawsuits. And there is some data the federal government has collected based on surveys that suggest that fewer than 1% of people who believe that their rights have been violated ever file a lawsuit. That is, you know, this is based on survey data. We don't know whether people who believe that their rights have been violated have actually had their rights violated would have found that they had their rights violated. But fair to say, there's a lot of people out there who believe they have been mistreated, but never bring a case at all.
Yeah, and when you have a number like 1%, if it's off by 2 or 3%,
it's still pretty darn low.
Yeah. Okay, let me ask one question, because otherwise I will never get back to it, and it's kind of jumping away for a second. But has the Biden administration or the Biden Justice Department made any moves in the right direction in terms of police accountability on a federal level?
Yes. And I realize when you ask that question, I didn't answer the second part of the question that you posed, which was, have things gotten better?
We'll get to that in a second.
George Floyd. Okay. Well, there's a couple things that the Biden administration has done. One thing that it has done is issue an executive order that essentially did the parts of the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act that failed in Congress sort of moved forward through executive order some of the things that it could. So that's one thing. It's very hard for the president to act without Congress on
Yeah.
reform, but that was one important move.
So whatever the whatever he could do by executive order, he did. But
yeah. The other thing that he's done, and time will just simply tell what impact this has, but is on judicial appointments. And he has appointed and made a priority of appointing people who have experience as public defenders, people who have experience as civil rights attorneys, people who are excellent lawyers, and I have every expectation will be responsible jurists, but who are more likely to see the world in a way that is consistent with that of a plaintiff in a civil rights case, more likely to understand the realities of litigating these cases and those challenges that I talk about in the book, than judges whose sole background is as a prosecutor or as a corporate attorney. And so I do think that may well have a significant impact on civil rights litigation moving forward.
Mm-hmm. So it's one of those, again, sort of upstream solutions. You put different people with different worldviews and different perspectives in the seat, and maybe, you know, a year from now, 3 years from now, a case a year from, you know, those sorts of things are changes. That's good. Okay.
Absolutely.
So have things gotten better since George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter protests?
So I think that the Black Lives Matter protests, the protests following the murder of George Floyd, have had a tremendous impact. I think that there's been a lot of conversation about backlash surrounding defund the police and that, you know, a lot of sort of criticism of the protests and the efforts made following George Floyd's murder. And putting aside those critiques, I think that what I would say, wholly apart from whether defund was the right language to use or all of that, I think that BLM and the protests following George Floyd's murder put attention on this issue that had not been there before. I think made more people sort of a tipping point about racism in policing and racially disparate policing. There were hundreds of police departments following the murder of George Floyd who created, implemented a variety of different protections, like ending chokeholds and no-knock raids, that I think are important. Do they completely transform policing? No, but important steps in the right direction. And they were also inspired legislators around the country to try to make changes in laws, some of which have been more successful than others, but I think were important changes. And I will say, sort of again, on the upstream point, I think more people than ever are focused on civil rights issues. More lawyers coming out of law schools are interested in bringing these cases. And so I do think that there is a way in which this will impact this uprising in the summer of 2020 will have long effects moving forward.
Yeah, it sounds like things that should have been and that could have been even implemented or passed prior to that, but just things go on, status quo sort of reigns. That this bump to the system has at least released a lot of that.
Yes,
yeah.
I agree.
So,
I agree.
Again, before we wade into qualified immunity, can you briefly talk about some of the other obstacles? And I'm going to read something that you wrote, and then you decide how you want to flesh it out, okay?
All right.
Decisions by the Supreme Court have erected barriers at every stage of litigation process. Make it difficult to find an experienced civil rights lawyer. Make it difficult to plead a plausible complaint. Difficult to prove a constitutional violation. Difficult to defeat qualified immunity. Difficult to hold local governments liable for the acts of their efforts. And difficult to obtain injunctive release. And there's a point, I think it's in The Better Way, your final chapter, where you sort of talk about reforms, where you have a series of even when paragraphs, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even when a plaintiff can this, even when it's the hoops before you ever get to qualified immunity or the hoops that surround qualified immunity. So could you let me just tell people first and then take on that question, which is what is all of that? This is Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Joanna Schwartz, professor of law at UCLA, who challenges law enforcement accountability, including the overuse of the claim of qualified immunity in her book Shielded, How the Police Became Untouchable. And you can learn more about her work at joannaschwartz.net. Okay.
Well, I appreciate that you asked the question and then you had all those other things to say. So I had a moment to think about what my answer should be. I really appreciate that. I think that the portion of the book that you read from the introduction does a very nice job of setting out my main point here, that qualified immunity is just one piece of the puzzle. And as you said, you need to find a lawyer, file a complaint, get past the prove a constitutional violation, and do all of those things before you even get to qualified immunity. I thought that I would explain that by referencing or describing one of the cases that I talk about in the book.
Excellent.
Good. So as I talk about in the book, there was an August night in 2016, and a woman named Vicky Timpa got a phone call that no one could ever expect or want. And it was a phone call from her ex-husband saying that her son Tony had died. And Tony was a 32-year-old executive, white guy, made $250,000 a year, living in Dallas. And Vicky couldn't imagine how her son had died. She called the Dallas Police Department several times. She learned that he had died in police custody, but they wouldn't give her a straight story about what had happened. One said that he died outside his car. One said that he had had a heart attack in a restaurant. She had no understanding of what had happened. But when the family viewed the body in the morgue, they saw that he had grass in his nose. Mm. And so how did that happen? So she started fighting for information. And Dallas, and under state law, wasn't obligated to give her any information because the case was under investigation. So she had no information about what had happened. She just knew that he had died. She went to try to find a lawyer to bring a lawsuit. And she was lucky to find a man named Jeff Henley, who practices in Dallas, does some civil rights work. But he wouldn't necessarily have brought this case. He knew these cases were very difficult to bring. Many people with civil rights violations lose because juries are unsympathetic. But he was sympathetic to her. In a request for information from Dallas, they had learned that the Dallas Police Department had body camera video of what had happened. So based on how sympathetic she was and the existence of body camera video, he decided to take the risk. And as a side note, many other people might not have taken that risk, and this is part of the reason it can be very difficult to find a lawyer. When they filed their lawsuit, they could only file it against the city of Dallas because they didn't know the names of the officers who brought the case or who had been there when her son died. So they named what you refer to as John Doe officers. And she had no details about what had happened to her son because the city of Dallas was keeping the body camera videos and other information that they had. After filing the complaint, the city of Dallas moved to dismiss it. And they moved to dismiss it based on Supreme Court ruling that says that in order to get to discovery, to be able to demand information from the other side, you have to plead what's called a plausible complaint, which the Supreme Court has said it needs to have enough facts that it shows a basis for relief. Well, Vicky Timpa didn't have that information because it was in the possession of the Dallas Police Department.
Right. In other words,
it, over.
It sounds like they're saying to get this information, you need to have this information.
Correct. That's precisely what they're saying. And not only were they saying that, they had the information.
Right.
I don't know what would have happened if the judge ultimately had to decide that case. But Jeff Henley, her lawyer, brought a separate lawsuit against the Dallas Police Department, demanding this information through a public records request.
Okay.
And ultimately, while the motion to dismiss the lawsuit was pending, he was able to negotiate a settlement, was able to get those records, and was able to find out what had finally happened to Tony. And again, another side note, another lawyer would not necessarily have put in the extra investment to bring that separate lawsuit. But Jeff Henley did.
Yeah, let me just jump in for another side note.
Yeah.
I don't lose track. You know your story, so
you won't
lose track.
I won't.
But
don't worry.
What you basically said is that while someone who had actually been wronged could not get this information, Freedom of Information Act, which doesn't have anything necessarily to do with a victim or a call, right, was able to.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize, again, just how maddening that is. That a journalist, had they made just a freedom of information, can get information, but someone who actually needs it can't.
Well, I will say there was also a journalist who was trying to get this information. The journalist for the Dallas Morning News ended up fighting for 3 years to get it released to the public. So it is a bit bizarre that a person bringing a lawsuit can't get this information through the case itself and has to bring a second case.
Yeah.
But it was actually even more difficult for the journalist to get this information. They had to fight for much, much longer. So, props to the journalist who did that fighting. Anyway, so they ultimately did get this video. And what the video showed and how they amended the complaint to add in this video was essentially that Tony Timpa had been having a mental health crisis. He called the police himself asking for assistance. And when the officers came, they zip-tied his feet, they handcuffed him, and two officers, one particularly, pressed his knees against Tony Timpa's neck and back for 14 minutes until he died.
Oh my God.
And not only did they press their hands, their weight, his their body weight against him, but after Tony was clearly dying, and you can see in the video when he is not resisting, not moving, making gurgling sounds, they joke like he is a boy who is fallen asleep and doesn't want to go to school. And they say, get up, Tony. We're going to make you Rudy Tooty Fruity waffles. We got your shoes downstairs.
Oh, my God.
And when the EMT finally get him, the officer who has put his foot on his neck and back for all of this time says, boy, I hope I didn't kill him. Everyone's laughing. And less than half an hour before he after he'd called for help, he was dead. So this is what happened to Tony Timpa.
Yeah.
This is the information that the Dallas Police Department was hiding.
Was hiding behind that video. And let me just say, I'm just going to share one thought that comes up as you're describing that. When someone can make those Rudy Tooty get up Tony jokes, it feels to me like they've done this before. If you know what I mean. You know what I mean? I just have that as I've been a screenwriter, and just thinking of, you don't just come up with that at the first time you've killed somebody, you know, or you've hurt someone or you've abused someone. I just go on, but.
And I don't know whether that's true.
Right.
Whatever had happened before, what I can tell you is that those officers were not disciplined. There was a disciplinary hearing, and the hearing officer said, if you basically keep doing what you're doing besides this event, I see a bright future for you.
Oh, my God.
So there was no meaningful discipline for these officers in this case. And
so now that she and her lawyer have the kind of a sense of the reality of what happened, what happens next?
Well, they file their lawsuit. They amend their lawsuit to include this additional information. There's no longer any basis to dismiss it. So they get into discovery. They do discovery in the case. And then 6 weeks after George Floyd was murdered in much the same way, a district court judge granted the officers qualified immunity. So this is partially why I say there's a lot to criticize about qualified immunity, but it's not just qualified immunity, because think of all of the steps that we have, or that the Timpas had to get past in order to get to this place. But the case was dismissed on qualified immunity grounds. And what that means is that even assuming there was a constitutional violation, courts are allowed to grant officers qualified immunity if the law was not clearly established. And the way in which the Supreme Court has interpreted clearly established law, it means that there has to be a prior court decision with nearly identical facts.
And flesh that out.
Holding identical conduct unconstitutional.
I was going to say, please flesh out how extreme that nearly identical is, so people get the true import.
Sure. Well, there's any number of cases that have made the news in which the grants of qualified immunity have seemed outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
One example to offer is a case brought by a man named Alexander Baxter. Mm-hmm. Alexander Baxter had burgled a home. The police were called. He sat down in surrender and raised his hands in the air. And the police nevertheless released a dog on him who attacked him, bit him under the arm that he had raised. And he was severely injured and needed medical treatment from the jail after he was arrested for over a month. When he brought a lawsuit, the case was dismissed on qualified immunity grounds. That same court had ruled that it was unconstitutional to release a police dog on a person who had surrendered by lying down. And what the Court of Appeals said was that there was distinction enough between the facts of a case where a person had surrendered by lying down and a case where a person had surrendered by sitting with their hands in the air that the law was not clearly established.
Yeah, now my guess is that someone who's listening and hears that just goes, come on, that's just crazy. But it happens over and over again throughout, because you have several, throughout one more, just to sort of go, you think that's crazy here?
Sure. Well, here's another example, a case called Jessup versus City of Fresno, which is a case where Fresno police were investigating a potential gambling violation. Someone had gambling machines in, you know, laundromats and things like that after a law had ruled those illegal. Mm-hmm. And the police did a search of the residence and found recorded $50,000 that they had recovered, but pocketed another $250,000 in rare coins and money, and never returned that. When the person sued, the officers were granted qualified immunity because there wasn't a prior court decision that had said it was unconstitutional to seize and keep, essentially to steal, evidence recovered during a search. So those officers were also let off the hook.
Right. In other words, if they stole that money in any other circumstance, it would be pretty clear that's a violation, right? I mean, if they weren't police, if you just stole and it was clear that you had stolen $225,000 in rare coins.
But they would be in prison.
But
yes.
Because they're police, it must be so taken for granted, this distinction, you know, that it's like, but to someone who's just listening, why is it different?
Well, the justification that the Supreme Court has offered for qualified immunity has shifted over time. But in the very beginning, when the doctrine was first created by the Supreme Court in 1967, they talked about the importance of giving officers a little bit of breathing room, giving them some discretion so that they weren't going to be threatened with the possibility of dereliction of duty if they didn't do their job and being sued if they did do their job. Mm-hmm. So giving them a little extra breathing room outside the bounds of the Constitution. But what it at that time when the Supreme Court created qualified immunity, they called it a good faith immunity.
That's
so
right.
The idea was it was this protection if officers acting in good faith stepped over the line and the line was not clear. But the court has increasingly strengthened what the legal protection is. It no longer turns on whether officers acted in good faith. They can act in bad faith, like the officers in Fresno who stole $250,000.
It's tough to call that good faith, right?
It didn't just fall into their pockets. So
and they didn't notice.
Even when officers have acted in bad faith, they're protected. So, and they're protected so long as they have the good fortune to have violated someone's rights in a way that is not precisely the way that a prior court has held unconstitutional. So this protection that was first about giving officers breathing room in really unsettled new constitutional areas when they've acted in good faith has now turned into really a sort of funhouse mirror version of itself.
That's right.
Where it's officers acting in bad faith, even when the conduct that they've done is obviously wrong, so long as there's not a prior court case that has said precisely that kind of force used, for example, is unconstitutional.
Right. So you've pointed out, and I hope people got that, two or three different instances where it seems this is the same crime, but it's not exactly the same crime. Okay. So... And you've also pointed out that I had a question here, which was, you know, is this one of those cases where something that was done for the best of intentions, you know, kind of got distorted? And there's some sense that's true. The breathing room, the good faith. But step by step, and you cite these steps, the Supreme Court has fattened and enlarged and loosened those boundaries to where now you can title the book Untouchable. what I don't want to get out of this conversation without citing is some of the Supreme Court's myths and the facts you've discovered that prove those myths are false.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, there are so many of them, but to give you
A flavor of it. Yeah.
A sense of it. You know, current debates around qualified immunity repeatedly say that without qualified immunity's protections, officers will be bankrupted for good faith mistakes they make in a split second. And this is in somewhat less fervent tones, the kind of justifications that the Supreme Court has also made for expanding the doctrine. But when I looked at police departments around the country, I got records from 81 law enforcement agencies across the country over a six-year period asking how often did officers contribute to settlements and judgments entered against them. I found only two of the 81 departments where there had been any contribution by an officer. The amount contributed was an average of somewhere around $4,000, not the makings of a bankruptcy petition. And that in the other jurisdictions, it was more likely that an officer would be struck by lightning than that they would have to contribute to a settlement or judgment during the course of their career.
Right. So I'm just going to rephrase just so people get it. So the myth that supporters and the Supreme Court have said is, you know, if they're liable for all these things, they'll be bankrupt. Turns out, as you said, two out of 81 departments do police officers have to pay any of it. In other cases, the police department or the government ends up picking up the bill. And that even when they are charged, and one other thing I wanted to say is we're not necessarily talking about death here. It isn't that they get $5,000 for murder, but it's any kind of misconduct. But still, the point is that, as you point out, not bankruptable. Go ahead.
No, and absolutely. And the reason for those financial protections is not qualified immunity. This is an important point as well, that the reasons that officers aren't paying anything in these cases is because there are state and local what are called indemnification agreements. They're agreements that when an officer is sued, a lawyer will be given to them and any settlement or judgment will be paid from the city's coffers. So it's a protection that the Supreme Court basically ignores in its cases, and that defenders of qualified immunity basically ignore.
What you're saying is they would be covered without qualified immunity. This whole
correct
notion that it's a potential financial hardship to actually have to pay for their mistakes is not even true, way before qualified immunity. Yep.
Exactly. And the other side of the other part of that myth that officers are going to be held liable or found to have violated the Constitution when they make split second mistakes in good faith ignores the way in which the Supreme Court's constitutional cases play out. So, you know, under the Supreme Court's rulings, the Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable searches and seizures is the reasonableness is viewed from the perspective of an officer. So a person can be assaulted, arrested, shot, or even killed and have done nothing wrong, but the officer may not have violated their constitutional rights if they acted reasonably. And the court has said reasonably can be mistakenly. Split-second decisions are already protected by the Constitution.
Aha. Uh-huh. So another justification for qualified immunity that is covered without qualified immunity.
And
that's basically, there's a litany of their justifications and the fact that when you do real-world research, they turn out to be either false or unnecessary. Okay.
Correct.
We've got, if I give you 3 minutes or so, talk a little bit. I know it's the hard part, and it's so in your book, right? It's the last chapter. And in so many books that I deal with, it's the last chapter. What can we do? And at least give people a taste of where potential reforms might be.
Sure. Well, and in some ways, because there's so much wrong, there's also a lot to do and a lot that can be done by listeners and really anyone who wants to make a difference. So, the short answer is that we need to dial back, take down some of these shields. And Congress or the Supreme Court could do a lot of this work. I don't have much expectation that they will. But that ends up meaning that there's a lot more to be done at state and local legislative community places. So here's just two quick suggestions.
Good.
One is at the state level, New Mexico and Colorado have both passed police reform bills that have essentially created a right to sue for violations of the state constitution without qualified immunity as a defense. Those are bills that have been introduced and unsuccessful in many other states, usually because union representatives offer these very same scare tactics for what would happen if
right.
it was made too easy to sue. So getting state legislatures to retake up those statutes to push them forward and create an alternate pathway to bring these claims.
Because the point that I want to emphasize in what you said is that the whole thing we ran into at first with qualified immunity is it's the federal constitution, and so the Supreme Court comes into play a lot. What you're saying is these bills that have succeeded in Colorado and New Mexico and have failed in California, Washington, Virginia, and elsewhere so far, to align it with the state constitution, so all of everything else that we've been talking about won't come into play.
Exactly, and the states really offer a clean slate to think in different ways about how this system should work. And that's what Colorado and New Mexico have done. The skies have not fallen in either state. We're gonna keep studying what has happened there, but I think that they are really bellwethers for us, and we should be learning a lot of lessons from them and from what they do.
And what I like about that is you're saying also that is something that if a listener is horrified, etc., this is an avenue they can look around for. What are the organizations in your state that are working on this and get to work? And is there kind of a place where that might be easy to find out?
Well, there is. I mean, the Institute for Justice, for example, and the ACLU both have state actions in this place. So I would look for the Institute of Justice and the ACLU's
very
state
good.
Courts project.
Very good. And you were about to say, and this will be kind of your closing.
That's fine. At a local level, there is a lot that people can do within their own city councils. Push your city council to make settlements and judgments come out of police departments' budgets. Push your city council to audit settlements and judgments in these cases and find out what's happening in these cases and how you can improve things in the future. Encourage your city government to rethink having police respond to people in mental health crisis,
right,
like Tony Timpa. And so there's a ton that can happen at the local level. And at the very, very most local level, I encourage your readers or your listeners, when they get a jury summons, to respond and serve happily, because having our jury system function and have people in those juries who view these cases with a neutral, a truly neutral eye is something that those who have suffered wrongdoing at the hands of police or other government officials truly need and often don't find when they finally get past all of these barriers and find their way to a jury.
Mm-hmm. And I did want to point out one noodle in what you said, which is that currently even that cities often pay the bill instead of the police department. And what you're saying is if you look at that and change that, perhaps there's an incentive for the police department to police themselves better.
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly.
Okay. So the book is Shielded, How the Police Became Untouchable. The website is joannaschwartz.net. JoannaSchwartz, one word, .net. And as she said, if you want to learn about reform efforts, the Institute of Justice or the ACLU can steer you in the right direction. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 10 to 15 links to articles to flesh out the conversation, email me at TEMcnally, TEMCNALLY, at mac.com. You can sign up at my site or email me. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts and at most of those podcast sites. And you'll find years of podcasts there. Archives include Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Keanu Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Joanna Schwartz, and keep up your good work.
Thank you. Thanks for the great conversation.